In some ways, when we look back over church history, if there's one century about which we know little, it's actually the second century. It's not that we don't know anything about it, it's just that comparatively, we know not that much. I mean, before it, we get to know lots of through the New Testament and what happens right after the New Testament. Later on, the church has grown a bit, there are more authors, there are more resources, but the second century, just don't maybe know as much. It's a transition period. And what a challenging time that must have been for the church. Second century, the church is still relatively small. They're in this large Roman Empire. Politics was still generally against Christianity, with persecution at times. Some of the leading thinkers of the time start to realize what Christianity is and what it is about and start writing against it, making fun of it, showing its inconsistencies or whatever they thought was against Christianity. The world was still generally predominantly pagan in all kinds of blends of religions and superstitions. The church at that time didn't have the apostles anymore. They had passed away. So new leaders had to be stepping up. And meanwhile, in the church, it's also where the first heretics start to pop up, false teachers. When you put all of that together, you realize that in the second century, but of course also before that, Christians didn't really have a lot going for them. And yet, what did they do in this hostile world? Did they batten down the hatches saying, like, we'll just ride this storm out, wait for something, some better opportunity, some better time for the church? They quietly huddle together, retreat to some fringe area, the Roman Empire. No, the accounts are pretty consistent. They just continue to do what Jesus and the disciples did. Preach the word to a world that didn't know God. In fact, even the second century gives rise to what we consider the first Christian apologists, the first Christian thinkers who start to write down their thoughts to defend the faith, giving all kinds of reasons and defenses for why Christianity should be believed. Christianity continued to spread among the poor, among the oppressed and the helpless. This is why many of the elite throughout the Roman Empire would make fun of Christians, because look, it's just the poor, the oppressed. And yet it continued to grow. Church continued its mission. And in a century where the deck might have been stacked against them, the church continued to grow. The church persevered by God's grace. More recently, studies of that century started also kind of pointing out parallels with maybe the kinds of things we see going around in our world, in the Western world today. Church and Christian influence might be becoming smaller and smaller, it might be diminishing. For quite many years now, leading academics, leading thinkers around the world will most likely be atheist or pagan rather than Christian. So yeah, society is undergoing rapid changes, and we all wonder, of course, what kind of course that is setting and whether that may lead to confrontation and conflict with Christianity. We might have those questions. We wonder, you know, what is going to happen in the future, whether that's us, next generation, beyond that. And then church historians remind us that such things like the second century. And if we look at our passage today, we see that Jesus, in his mission sermon, has prepared the disciples and the church for the first century, for the second century, and really for every century after that. The clear mission and encouragement. And that's what we'll look at this morning. The teachings of Jesus Christ, we continue that series. This morning it will be about sheep, snakes, doves, and wolves, and we'll look at the mission and the encouragement. We just read it, and this is the mission that Jesus gives his disciples. He says, "Do not go among the Gentiles or enter any town of the Samaritans. Go rather to the lost sheep of Israel. As you go, preach this message. The kingdom of heaven is near. Heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse those who have leprosy, drive out demons. Freely you have received, freely give. Do not take along any gold or silver or copper in your belts. Take no bag for the journey or extra tunic or sandals or a staff. For the worker is worth his keep." A couple of things stand out. They just continued the mission that Jesus was doing as he had healed, as he had driven out demons, as he has preached that the kingdom was coming, so his disciples were going to do the same. It's a lot of parallels there. But before we look further at these words, we also have to be aware of maybe one challenge that we have with applying these words. Mission here is specifically given to the disciples, and that shows in some of the things that Jesus says. Maybe we read this and we realized, hey, that's interesting. The disciples are first of all told not to go to the Gentiles and not even to go to the Samaritans. They first have to go to Israel. Jesus is worried or concerned for the lost sheep of Israel and wants to gather them in first. I mean, that did continue on even among Paul and others who went out into the world, and they always went to the Jews first to preach the gospel. But we also know that later on in Matthew, Jesus is going to say, go out, even beyond the Gentiles, even beyond the Samaritans. So when we read this, there are going to be some things that we see, hey, this is applied specifically to the disciples then, maybe not as much to us now. Same actually as Jesus says, you know, don't take along gold, silver, copper, bag, tunic, sandals, or staff. Later on in Luke 22, near his death and when he's about to be arrested, he's going to remind his disciples of this and saying, I sent you out without anything. Did you lack anything? And they'll say, no. He says, well, this time, be prepared. Grab your stuff. Make sure you take even a sword along because you'll need it. The mission changes maybe a little bit. More preparation there. So some of this is specific. But in general, as we read this mission, we can notice a lot of things of importance. First of all, when Jesus sends out his disciples, this mission becomes what is all important for them. So they're completely focused on it. He says, don't worry about supplies. God will provide for you. Just preach freely, just as you've received freely. Preach and give. You're supposed to spread the gospel far and wide within Israel, go wherever they can, and yet at the same time, he also says, expect support from those who believe your words. For as Jesus also says, wherever you go, the message of the kingdom will bring about two responses, two results. It may result in peace, in blessing for those who take care of you, those who receive you, those who listen to your words. It will bring judgment to those who reject you. It's really they're rejecting me. They're rejecting Jesus Christ and his message. He says, move on. Continue to preach to those who are willing to listen. But then Jesus summarizes and really transitions to the topic of opposition with these words. He says, I am sending you out like sheep among wolves. Therefore be as shrewd as snakes and as innocent as doves. Jesus says to the disciples, you can go and preach freely, perform miracles as signs of the coming of the kingdom. He says, God will supply, but in the end, the mission will not be an easy one. And the theme of sheep continues, except for now it's the disciples who are the sheep, and they are sent out among wolves. They are sent out into what will be a dangerous and also a threatening world. And much of the rest of Jesus' sermon will focus on that. But this is what Jesus tells them to do. In this case, therefore, be as shrewd as snakes and as innocent as doves. And it is actually surprising that Jesus would use that image, the illustration of a snake, to say that's kind of what you have to be. Likely all know that, yes, right away in Genesis, the snake is that crafty, cunning, shrewd animal in the garden. But to balance things out, Jesus also says, well, be as innocent as doves. You have to be as crafty and as cunning as a snake, but without its bite, without its evil, pure, harmless. That's what we are to be like. Whenever we do, whenever the disciples go, that is supposed to be the hallmark of their Christian ministry. Maybe we need to think about that also today. As the church, would we say we are as shrewd as snakes and as innocent as doves? Does this describe the church today? Does that describe us? Reading this week, one commentator notes that Christians often invert the two. It says that we are as guilty as serpents and as stupid as doves, the exact opposite of what Jesus actually has intended. It's a rather harsh comment on maybe the state of the church and of Christians in general. We also then have to wonder, is that the case? Are we shrewd, focused, thoughtful about what the calling of the church is in this world? Are we thoughtful about how we use the time that we live in to our advantage, to the advantage of God's kingdom, to the advantage of the church? You know, in light of what has happened in the last decades, you know, with all of its rapid changes in the world and in society, especially U.S., but also Canada and elsewhere, you know, one prominent Christian thinker has said that Christians are in the habit of fighting yesterday's battles with the day before yesterday's weapons. Says Christians are in the habit of fighting yesterday's battles with the day before yesterday's weapons. It has that imagery of, like, for when it comes to the church, you know, we show up over here with, well, the battle is going on over there, and the battle's going on with, I don't know, tanks and nuclear weapons, and we show up with muzzle loaders. Or, you know, bow and arrow, something like it. We show up, wrong place, wrong time, way too late, and underprepared. Wouldn't be a very shrewd tactic. Now, this Christian thinker wasn't necessarily thinking about mission, but he was touching on the fact that it seems that often Christians in the church doesn't understand the times that they live in, or actually how we are to use them to our advantage. And some have used examples, or I've heard this apply to, for example, the legalization of gay marriage in the United States. A Christian author says, like, this is one of these examples. So I guess a couple of years ago, wouldn't know exactly now how many, Supreme Court was dealing with that question, and for many Christians, that seemed to be the defining moment. You know, whatever the Supreme Court does, that is what's going to define the church, that's what's going to define society. And this author says, well, is that really the case? Because in truth, the battle had already been decided many years before by what has been happening in society. Society had already changed, and the Supreme Court was only going to reflect that. Well, too little, too late, showing up on the wrong battlefield, underprepared. But in all honesty, and I think if we reflect on that, we also maybe realize that that kind of reflects our own worries and our own thinking on many topics. Many things are going on today. Think about it. I think many of us will recognize that there are maybe forces at work, some thoughts out there that might erode the importance and the place of families in society. In the church, we appreciate families, we believe in covenant, and we encourage that, and so it's worrisome maybe as we see this at work in society. And we maybe worry, what about that? What does that mean for our families? What does that mean for family as an institution going forward and for the church? What can we do about that? And that's fair. Maybe we should be more worried about it. But are we also shrewd enough to realize that here in Vernon, Feed the Streets, fills blessing boxes throughout town. And of course, many of you know and are even involved, and you know that these blessing boxes take care of the homeless. Yes, but there are also other blessing boxes who are filled with bread to help what is most likely mostly single moms and elderly widows, widowers. I might be assuming too much, but I'm guessing that most of those individuals will be able to tell all of us something about the erosion of family in society today, just by personal story. For them, that bridge was crossed a long time ago. And I don't think it's therefore that surprising that many churches, or if not many, at least some churches, Canadian Reformed or others also here in Vernon, are spending time saying we ought to reach out with the gospel to single mothers, to widowers who are alone, and that they might have ministries that are quite successful in doing so. It's one example. Take another. You might be aware how transgenderism is also getting more attention, even in our government. There are certain bills going through Parliament, and or that might change how the church or anyone really can counsel someone who is struggling with their identity. ARPA gets involved, and we maybe think about these things, and it's kind of worrisome. We also have to wonder, though, if we're shrewd, are we going to focus on what is happening in Parliament, or are we aware of how many other people, not just Christians, but it might be colleagues, friends, neighbors, whoever, are also confused by these changes? Or is a church considering that actually between now and 5, 10, 20 years from now, there are going to be many teens or young people who are going to be deeply confused, probably feeling abandoned because their parents, their teachers, their medical professionals, their government all encourage them to pursue their dream of gender transition, and yet that didn't bring them lasting peace? And what is the church going to be doing then? Are we going to be silent? Will we retreat? Will we be still licking our wounds about how the society has changed? Or will we be there also to preach the gospel and tell them about a Savior who has created them in the image of God? Another example, we worry about the fact that the internet is full of explicit content and what that actually does to families and churches and everything in between. And can we also guess that also outside the church, there are people who are harassed, helpless, who are looking to break their addiction, and who could use the good words of a Savior who forgives and restores? Some worry about immigrants coming to Canada and how that will change society, how especially they bring their own religions, and how that would change things. And yet at the same time, do we realize that it is a lot easier to convert a Muslim here in Canada than it is to do somewhere where there's Sharia law? And there will be many, many other examples like it. If we're shrewd, we'll see the opportunities also within our own time, as well as the challenges. It's what Jesus does. That's why he sends them out. And if we see the opportunities, we cannot help but also repeat Jesus' words, where it starts just before chapter 10, when he says to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into his harvest field." We don't want to be a church that might, in general, read, you know, be as shrewd as serpents and as innocent of doves, and think that we've done our job, that we can point out the wolves that are out there. As if there they are. It's like, yes, Jesus knows there's wolves out there. That's why he sent us out. It's important to know that, because it means that we might not fall prey to the wolves as much as we are bound to do, or that we might. But that's not the objective. The whole point of his speech and the whole point of sending out the disciples is that he may gather in the lost sheep. In a changing world, we'll be as shrewd as snakes and as innocent as doves. Though times may change, do we see that the mission of the church has always been the same, whether it's the first, the second, the third, 21st century? To go out as sheep among wolves and preach the gospel. And how are we fulfilling that ministry, that mission, shrewdly and innocently today? And no, we don't have to be naive and think that this mission is easy. We just go out there and we preach on the street corner and people will be all happy because they never heard of the gospel before. Jesus tells us that it is sending out sheep among wolves. It's not going to be easy. There are dangers in being a disciple of Jesus Christ. There are difficulties, there are rejections, there is even persecution and strong opposition. And that has always been the case when it comes to the gospel. And we read this and we might be thinking, like, it's not very smart to send out sheep among wolves. And yet also throughout the following verses, Jesus offers encouragement. He coaxes us. He assures us as the good shepherd that he is, that he doesn't abandon us. I know we're maybe not used to shepherds today, and yet if anyone has some sheep, they or has seized that around here, also in Vernon, we also maybe know that, yeah, you can put your sheep out on pasture and they'll be prey to coyotes in no time. But it only takes one donkey, one alpaca, one guard dog to keep them really safe. And how much more will one great good shepherd of Jesus Christ keep watch over his church? Now in what follows, and as we read it, you might have noticed, Jesus covers a lot of different topics, a lot of different struggles and opposition to the church, and it's hard to maybe find a structure or break it down. But so that we can kind of cover it this morning, maybe let's think about three main points that he makes. There's the threats to the gospel, there's the cost of the gospel, and there's the reward of this gospel mission. First, the threats. Jesus warns us right from the beginning that actually it's all kinds of men will hate us because of him. He mentions those in political power among the Gentiles, those governors and kings. He mentions those who with the religious authorities who will flog them and will also throw them out of the synagogues. Yes, he says even family members will pose a threat, will oppose them. You will oppose them. But sprinkled throughout, Jesus continues to remind us and encourage us. He says, "As even though you're facing those with so much influence, with so much power, don't fear about what you are going to say." He says he will provide the words. We just have to think of church history, which is full of martyrs who with psalms and confessions just faced their opponents, maybe without fear, probably with fear, and yet speaking wonderful words. I mean, that's the Spirit. Jesus reminds us that those who stand firm to the end will be saved, that he will come again, not to judge us, to judge those who persecute us, the church. Jesus also reminds us of the cost of his mission. And in summary, the cost is our cross that we have to bear. But he says also that those who take up their cross, that terrible instrument of death and of shame, that must have horrified all of his listeners when he compared it to that. He says, yet they will find life. They will find their lives. He reminds us that life is more than the body. Yeah, there will be people out in the world who may kill our body, but they cannot kill our soul. It says, fear God who can destroy both soul and body in hell. And he says, just entrust yourself to God. He says, are not two sparrows sold for a penny? Yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from the will of your Father. Even the very hairs of your head are all numbered. So don't be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows. Jesus reminds us that God cares for the cheapest, the most common bird that you can find. and he cares for it, and he knows what happens to it, how much more will the shepherd of Israel care for you? And lastly, once again, briefly, Jesus speaks of reward. Those who care about his mission, who care about his church, who support it, who welcome apostles into their home, they will receive a prophet's reward or a righteous man's reward. And likely, Jesus here too is thinking of the Old Testament. All these stories of prophets going out and wherever they received hospitality, these people were blessed and helped. And yet, Jesus also says and ends saying that if anyone gives even a cup of cold water to one of these little ones because he is my disciple, I tell you the truth, he will certainly not lose his reward. No matter your position in your place in the church or what you're able to contribute or the gifts that God has given you in furthering his kingdom, no matter what we do, it will not go unnoticed by the Lord, and it will not go without reward. And if we consider and read through this again, chapter 10, you'll notice how often there's that refrain that Jesus says, do not be afraid, do not fear them, do not be afraid, for he is with us. Yes, he's brutally honest. He just says, I send you as sheep among the wolves, but I am with you. It says the Spirit is with us to provide us with words so that we may know what to say. He says his Father is with us. He who cares for even the sparrows will care certainly for us, noticing every hair that falls from our head. And Jesus is with us throughout this whole passage. He identifies with his apostles. He identifies with his church. He counts on them threatening us because of him, because we're members of his household. He counts on us acknowledging him and says, if you acknowledge me before the world, I will acknowledge you before the Father. And he says at the end, if anyone receives one of these little ones, one of my disciples, they've received me. The shepherd is always with his sheep. That is our comfort. It doesn't really matter what happens in the world around us. Jesus calls us to just be as shrewd as serpents and as innocent as doves. Sends us out. The mission continues, the harvest fields are plentiful. The harvest is plentiful. The mission of the church hasn't changed. And neither has Christ's words, his encouragement for us. Amen.